Bienvenue pour cette table ronde numéro 2 qui est consacrée aux outils de financement de la transition bas carbone à l'échelle mondiale dans le contexte post-Covid. Donc c'est un sujet évidemment très important, le financement de la transition énergétique dans les pays émergents. Et nous accueillons pour cette table ronde trois experts internationaux de premier plan. Tout d'abord, Jean-Charles Ourcade, qui est chercheur au CIRED et qui est également auteur un des auteurs du GIEC. Nous accueillons Monsieur Glemarek, qui est directeur exécutif au Green Climate Fund. Et puis, nous accueillons enfin Monsieur Deepak Dagupta, qui est également un des auteurs du GIEC et qui a évidemment d'autres activités dont il pourra faire état sur sa présentation. Moi, je voudrais remercier ces trois experts de nous avoir accordé du temps. Je donne tout de suite la parole à Jean-Charles. Merci à lui d'avoir bien voulu organiser cette table ronde.
Well, so I will start in English, and then I will explain why at the end. I will come back to French. The idea that first, thanks for our colleagues and friends, and the idea would be that 15 minutes. So we'll save 15 minutes to make some form of a wrap up. I will pass to French to make some personal comments about some implications of what has been said, and including to make the link with the discussion we've had in the previous session about the question of the credibility of carbon assets, the question of the measurements, the question of the taxonomy, and so on and so forth. So I will pick myself in French 15 minutes at the end. So first, thank you, Yannick, and you can start when you want.
Many thanks, Jean-Charles. At the onset, I would like to deeply thank you and all the organizers for inviting me to join this roundtable. I will try to focus my presentation on the role of public policies to create and develop the green markets in order to address climate change. We are not on track to achieve the Paris Agreement. In 2020, the mean global average temperature has reached 1.2 degrees Celsius against the pre-industrial level. And WMO estimates that we have a 40% chance to cross the 1.5 degrees Celsius at least once in the next 5 years. And based on existing greenhouse gas emission trends, we could cross the 2 degrees Celsius very early in the beginning of the second part of the century. This said, there are a number of very positive developments, and one of the most positive one is certainly the recent movement toward net zero emission. 131 countries accounting 73% of the global greenhouse gas emission have taken or is thinking about taking a net zero emission commitment by 2050 or by 2060. And if these countries were to be able to implement this net zero commitment, we could actually remain within the Paris Agreement. The key issue is that how do we translate this net zero greenhouse gas emission commitment into action? We know that we will need more technologies, and we know that we will need much, much more finance. We need to dramatically increase the amount of investment in green climate resilient products. How do we mobilize such a large amount of finance? In theory, it should not be a problem. With close to $14 trillion of assets earning negative yield in OECD countries, and about $26 trillion of very profitable opportunities in green climate resilient investment from now to 2030, with the bulk of it in developing countries where we will have the majority of the new investment in infrastructure. And so normally the money should flow from the capital should flow naturally from low yield assets toward high yield assets. Now, in a manner reminiscent to the classic Lucas paradox, this is not happening. The money is simply not flowing from this low-earning yield assets to this potentially much higher earning yield assets in for low-emission climate resilient development. And one of the reasons is because basically there are a number of barriers. There are a number of technical, macroeconomic, policy barriers to this flow of capital. And for example, even if you have the best wind resources in the world, nobody is to invest in a wind power plant if the fossil fuel is subsidized at 90% in a given geography, or if it takes the approval of 27 administration to get the city license for your wind power plant. And so, what we know for sure is that if we want to accelerate climate investment, we need policies. We need public policies. Bloomberg Finance estimated that countries with a conducive policy framework for low carbon climate resilient investment could attract 7 times more investment than countries with an incomplete or unclear or inconsistently implemented policy framework. So, but what kind of policies do we need to basically accelerate this investment? There are two main schools of policy making to catalyze climate finance. And Jean-Charles and I basically use the terminology of market fixing and market shaping in a recent publication, because these two terms have been used by a number of economists and practitioners. And the reason why we decided to use the terminology of market shaping and market fixing is because it goes far beyond the traditional carbon pricing versus sectoral policies divide. I will try to share my screen to use very quickly a PowerPoint to go through through these two approaches. The first type of approach, market fixing, basically try to rely on price and risk signal in order to create a strong demand for low carbon climate resilient investment. And as such, it's called for carbon pricing, it's called for climate risk disclosure, and a green taxonomy. And these different instruments basically aim to create a demand for green products. In theory, carbon pricing and climate risk disclosure should be enough to dramatically catalyze climate finance. In practice, it does not. Why carbon price normally should normally be enough? It's very unlikely that most government will be able to come with carbon price high enough to cover the normal noise of the business cycle. When it comes to climate risk disclosure, it's still very voluntary, and most companies do not disclose, and those who disclose only part of the information. In parallel to this first approach of market fixing, a second approach has been increasingly used over the past 30 years by practitioners such as me, by managers of multilateral climate funds, in order to catalyze the climate finance. And this approach basically relies on a number of different public policy instruments, information, control and regulatory instruments, economic and market instruments, institutional instruments, and financial instruments. Right now, we have close to 5,000 different public policy instruments that are being used to catalyze finance in different types of sectors. and that the instruments and both are directed both at the demand side and the supply side of the green market creation and development. One of, and you might be, the audience might be familiar with a number of these instruments, such as, for example, feed-in tariff for renewable energy. The financial instrument, the last category, is basically used to de-risk a specific project, and it's often referred under the terminology of a blended finance. Now, the key issues with market-shaping instruments is that they are often expensive to deploy, and therefore their effectiveness and credibility depends very much on the strength of the public purse. So we have two different approaches, each of them potentially with a lot of potentials, but also some major constraints. The one thing that we have learned over the past three decades is actually this two different set of approaches have very strong synergies. And if we can deploy them in an integrated manner, we can actually remove some of the constraints associated with each of them in isolation. And I will try to use a set of four graphs to illustrate this in a visual manner. Let's imagine that we take an archetypical carbon-intensive project, that is the red curve, and an archetypical low-carbon climate project, that is the green curve. Basically we show the cumulative cash flows throughout the times. And what we see is that even if the low-carbon project has lower operation and maintenance cost, basically wind power plant will not need to purchase fuels, the higher capital intensity, the higher upfront capital requirement will not be compensated by this lower operation and maintenance cost. So at the end of the day, the cumulative cash flow of the high carbon projects will be superior. The final NPV will be higher than for the low carbon projects. Worse, if most low carbon projects will be facing a number of policy and technical and infrastructure and logistical constraints. For example, if I go back to the illustration of a wind power project requiring 10, 20, 30 different administrative instructions, if something like that does happen to a project, you can basically have gigantic cost overrun. Same thing if you use a technology that is not proven and you have some difficulties to basically commission your installation, you can also suffer some major cost overrun. And in this graph, basically we visualize the idea that once you reach minus 20 in your cash flow, you basically lose the confidence of your bankers and you end up with a major liquidity and potentially solvency problem that leads you to abandon your project. And so if I'm an investor, and if I see something like that, with a high carbon project, I will get a better NPV, and I do not have the risk of liquidity problem or solvency problem arising from the cost of development associated with a new technology. So I will basically stick to my high carbon project. And that's the idea, and one of the fundamental ideas of a market fixing approach. So with a carbon tax, I suddenly increase the comparative value of my low carbon projects. And in addition, if I can lower the interest rate for the financing of my low carbon project, because bankers and entrepreneurs know value the lower physical and transition risk associated with climate finance thanks to the climate risk disclosure initiative, suddenly my low carbon projects becomes seemingly much more attractive. My NPV will be higher than for my high carbon project. But my problem of a potential cost overrun with a new technology, especially in a new geography, does not disappear. So if I'm an investor, I will most likely prefer to bet on a high carbon project that will have a lower net present value, but a lower risk of cost overrun. And that's the reason why we see a lot of effort being invested in carbon pricing, in climate risk disclosures, but still a very limited deal flow, still a dramatic lack of projects. Entrepreneurs still do not jump. Now, if I add to this carbon fixing approach, if I add to this market fixing approach, a market shaping approach, and for example, I try to de-risk my low carbon project. I de-risk it in an upfront manner, for example, through providing a project development fund to enable the entrepreneurs to cover all the cost of the feasibility study, or I de-risk it in an upfront manner through providing a state guarantee that if there is a cost, a cost of around 50% of the cost will be taken care by the state guarantee, or if I de-risk the project through, for example, having a blended finance where the public authority will provide some first lost equity or will provide an extension of the loan tenor, etc. There I'm in a very different situation because the risk of liquidity and solvency problem associated with a cost overrun is dramatically mitigated. And suddenly, even if I face a cumulative cash flow of minus 20 at the beginning, I can still recover thanks to the de-risking, and ultimately my NPV for the low carbon climate project will be higher than for the high carbon project. And if you if with climate risk disclosure you also enable financiers and entrepreneurs to factor in the calculation the risk of, for example, an extreme weather event, or the risk of an accelerative obsolescence of their products because of a new carbon regulation, suddenly your low carbon climate project becomes much, much, much more interesting than your high carbon project. And so this is, of course, a very simplified visual way to describe it, but in a sense, by using a combination of different policy instruments, some relying on carbon pricing and the climate risk disclosure, some relying on blended finance or on the sectoral policies, you can achieve your objective of increasing the comparative advantages of low carbon against high carbon projects in a cost-effective manner. The what I'm saying is should be relatively straightforward and obvious, and one should wonder, but why do we even need to discuss it? It's obvious that we should try to deploy the as many instruments as possible and maximize the synergies between them. Because if you can de-risk with market shaping, you do not need as high a carbon price to have also an impact. Well, in practice, it's seldom done. It's very, very rare to see market transformation efforts that relies on a portfolio of instruments. What we are seeing is often the effort focusing only on the subset, so on the basically on pricing and risk disclosure, or only on the subset of sectoral policies. Now, the Green Climate Fund is the largest multilateral climate fund in the world. It did account for about 2/3 of the finance provided by multilateral climate funds in the world in last year. And we are capital agnostic. We can provide any kind of grant and non-grant support to green investors. And so we often use grant to help governments to put in place a conducive policy framework for green investment. And so it can include putting in place sector policies such as feed-in tariff or green procurement or minimum energy performance standards or bans on the on CFL bulbs, etc. It's basically up to each geography to identify what will be the best portfolio of policy instruments to create a conducive environment for green investment. So we can use grant to provide this kind of support to governments in developing countries, and we can also provide non-grant instruments, loans, guarantees, equities, in order to directly de-risk some individual projects. Even if you have an increasingly supportive policy environment, you will need a number of pioneer projects, a number of market-creating projects to establish a track record. Bankers think by track records. They look at whether the last project did work or not, what was the return of the last project. So often when you engage in a green market creation and development, you do not want to only work on the national and sectoral and sub-regional policies, but you also want to work on de-risking a number of market creating projects. And so here this graph understand, and is not the most user-friendly graph, but it's visualized the type of blended finance structure that the Green Climate Fund use in order to de-risk market-creating projects. And so, for example, we have we are co-financing a project for private equity investment at the sub-national level in climate mitigation and adaptation in 42 countries in the world, called the Sub-National Climate Fund. And half of these 42 countries are MDCs and seeds, least developed countries and small island states. And supporting private equity investment at the sub-national level is particularly critical because 80% of the investment will take place at the sub-national level. Now, it's next to impossible to get private equity investment in MDCs and seeds. It's next to impossible to get private equity investment at the sub-national level, even in middle to high income countries. And it's extremely difficult to mobilize private equity investment for climate mitigation and adaptation. So how did we succeed in mobilizing institutional investors to provide capital for investment in climate mitigation and adaptation at the sub-national level in LDCs and TPs? We basically de-risk the entire fund. We are providing a $150 million first loss equity to enable the fund manager to mobilize $600 million from its senior equity from institutional investors. And the $750 million are expected to leverage the same amount in entrepreneurial equity and after $1.5 billion in debt finance. So with $150 million of first lost equity, we could potentially catalyze $3 billion for investment in climate at the sub-national level. First lost equity means that if somebody loses one's money, it will be us. We will be the first to lose some money. When we provide a cushion for basically more risk-adverse institutional investors such as pension funds. Now, this model, we are using it for a number of different type of investment. We are, for example, using it for providing risk capital for innovative adaptation technologies. Same thing, very difficult to mobilize risk capital for startups. With a first lost equity, we can reassure institutional investors. We are using also, right now we are exploring a very similar model for establishing a green guarantee company, where there we will provide a callable equity, and this green guarantee company that will basically provide some credit enhancement to green bonds to be floated by firms and public and commercial banks in developing countries. And so maybe I will stop here. That's in a sense the type of integrated green market creation and development efforts that the Green Climate Fund supports.
Thank you, Yannick. I think the best is that I will pass the floor to Deepak, because then we will have a comprehensive discussion. Perhaps I should have said that just before this introduction. Even though the audience is very well informed, I should insist on the fact that there will not be any green transition, even in Europe, if this transition doesn't occur also in developing countries that represent more or less two-thirds of the investment needs in infrastructure investments, transportation, energy, and so on, over the forthcoming decades. I will come back to that at the end, but that's important to say that we talk about developing countries, but we talk also of Europe and what is happening in the world, okay? That's fine, that's really important. So Deepak, Deepak was a long time ago the first economic advisor of the Prime Minister in India before the existing one, and then was one of the first member of the first board of the GCF, and now he works for the IPCC. So that he is very he is still a very influential person in the field. So Deepak, up to you.
Thank you, Jean-Charles, and that was a lovely presentation by Yannick, and I'm so delighted to see the Green Climate Fund doing such an innovative sets of initiatives. And every time I see the meeting reports from the GCF, I'm actually very pleased, despite all the noise that we hear about how the GCF is functioning. It's actually doing an incredibly difficult job in it. So my 10 minutes, next 10 minutes, will be on three things. First, we have some missing action. There is a big elephant in the room that is not present. And I want to talk about what is that big elephant. And it's about sovereign guarantees. We need countries to play a role. GCF can't do it. Financial actors can't do it. This is the big missing elephant in the room. And Europe is absolutely central. And you have to, my first message to this audience is, if Europe doesn't wake up to what is at stake, we lose the whole game. Number two in the 10 minutes I'll talk about is why, and Jean-Charles talked about it, why do we care about what is happening beyond my country's borders? If you're sitting in France, why should I care about what is happening in Senegal, in Rwanda, in all of Africa or in India or elsewhere? Why, as a French taxpayer, do I have to take the burden of something that is happening thousands of miles away? So that's the second one I'll talk about. And the third is, we're all scientists now, and in science what we use is the concept of trial, test the idea. Try it out and and see whether it works or not, but do the trial very efficiently. So I'll talk about a design lab. So those are the three things that I want to just spend a moment on. I had some slides. I'm not going to use slides. I'll tell you the story straight as it comes. So the first issue is, what is this big elephant that is missing? It's about sovereign guarantees. The think about the problem of the low carbon transition as one of scale and urgency. The scale is the world as a whole is investing around $500 billion of investments in low carbon projects around the world. 500 billion sounds a lot, but it is actually trivial. What we need, and we've got a very thin slice, we need to invest around maybe $3 trillion a year, five times bigger than what the whole world is investing right now. So we have an urgency, and you can't get that to happen without using the power of sovereign guarantees to de-risk. What Yannick was talking about, you have to fundamentally, we have to rethink and reshape the way we're going to change the scale and urgency to de-risk. Why do we say, so is this money not available? Is it a problem that we don't have enough investment funds? Not true. Yannick talked about $14 trillion in Europe. In Europe, Europe is central. Remember, Europe is an aging population. You are an old population. This is the problem that we are fighting across generations. We are investing in low carbon transition because there's a 30-year-old growing somewhere in France and outside that needs to have a future. And we are the people in the 60 plus, at least for me, sitting there with piles of cash and telling my investment bankers, don't invest in anything that is risky. Well, we will find that risk coming soon enough. So the problem is that the world is awash in excess savings. Incredible. We have $200 trillion in pension funds, in stock markets. We've just spent $1 trillion investing in bitcoins. Absolutely useless stuff. Central banks have produced, in 1 year, we've invested $1 trillion in bitcoins. As an economist, as a social scientist, I can tell you there is nothing more useless except for rewarding ourselves older age groups. So we've got a problem. And the reason, the second part of it is public guarantees, sovereign guarantees, countries acting is critical. Why sovereign guarantees? The question is, what is it about sovereign guarantees beyond GCF is needed? Because, as Yannick said, exactly right, project risks are incredibly high in the early stages. These are long duration, costly capital investments with new technologies. There's lots of uncertainties. Policy making. Yannick talked about we get the policies right, projects will happen. But the sense about policy is incredibly costly for all governments. Think about where you're sitting in Europe. If you do a little policy change, it is extremely costly politically and economically to make policy. In order to make that happen, you need the power of collective. And that's why sovereign guarantees. Why do sovereign guarantees? It leverages 15 times. For every dollar of guarantee, you can get 15 times the investment happening. Default rates. The question about do projects fail when you guarantee them? It's incredibly low default rates. USAID has been investing in low-income Africa with guarantees over the last 20 years, two decades, in small-scale enterprises. Some of the highest risks you would take. And the default rate is 2.3%. That's all the default rate is. So it's not a question of default. EU, and the third part is EU. What is Europe doing? Europe is investing $550 billion with internal guarantees. So there is a big problem that we have when we think about the climate change, that climate change is not within borders problem. It is a problem which is a global problem, and therefore it needs instruments which are global. So that's where we are at. That's why we need sovereign guarantees to de-risk exactly the things that Yannick talked about. Sovereign guarantees can be organized in many ways. You can have, and the other problem that we have is multilateral development banks. They can't actually do it. Neither GCF nor the multilateral development funds can do it. We need governments to be coming into play. So I want us to be thinking about how are we going to be able to cross the borders. Now, the second part of the problem. The second part of the problem is we've got, think about developing countries in two blocks, although it is not politically the correct move. Think about that EMD, the IEA, International Economic Agency, just issued a report 2 weeks back, which looks at where are the investments needed other than in China. So they divided. And two-thirds of the low-carbon investments will need to happen in Africa, will need to happen in South Asia, will need to happen in Latin America. And these are countries which are in real trouble after the pandemic. They are, their debts are soaring. They have massive long-term health costs. They will not be able to undertake the investments that are needed in low carbon transition. And this is the challenge, double reason why you need this kind of building of trust and confidence. And Europe is absolutely central to be able to do this, which is to take the plunge. So Europe should be thinking about, when you're thinking about low carbon investments, I don't want you to be thinking about building Norway, building another project in the North Sea. That's not where the issue is. Why? Because that North Sea wind project is going to cost maybe 10 times higher per unit of carbon reduction than if you were to invest in Africa, where they're burning the trees in order to produce their energy needs. So that's the scale of problem that we have. So that's why developing countries are in trouble. Now we need to think about a unified planet. We need to think about investment strategies that meet that needs. Last question is the design lab. And I'll conclude with this. What we need is to test these ideas out. There will be 5 ideas out there. Test it out. Problem with the G20 is it's doing what I call financial engineering. They're tinkering at the margin, setting up a little unit there, little stuff there, infrastructure hub in Singapore, asking the multilateral development banks to do what they cannot do. And the end problem is that we're not approaching it scientifically to understand which policy works best and how to do it. Thank you, Jean-Charles.
Thank you to have been very short and efficient as usual, Deepak. I think we can start a discussion. And Frank, is there some reactions for the audience? And we can continue on that, okay? Then, perfect. So, if I try to make, because you have my personal visions of that, but simply what is important in this discussion is that we have perhaps to clarify for the audience some issues and perhaps to see what are the major obstacles to move ahead on that, okay? My reactions as I was part of the report with Yannick and others, okay? And now, first we can perhaps try to develop just a bit more with Deepak and then come back to Yannick. The question of the major obstacle, because Deepak, you ended to the design lab. I can perhaps develop the implicit behind that, okay? I was part of a discussion in France for a report 3 years ago, and when we discussed with the people in the Treasury, for example, I assure that you have a lot of things to say about that, you can talk with the Agence Française pour le Développement and other investors, okay? Then the question is not that you don't have some form of agreement on paper. In practice, when you read literature for the reports for the multilateral banks and so on and so forth, all the ingredients, they are there. But the question is that How can you guarantee that the money will be well used? How any system of public guarantees will add, and in terms of raising the arbitrariness of choices in the PPP, in the public and private partnership, and then in practice, not only will lose money, but in practice we'll make white elephants, bad projects. Can you simply try to make the link between that and this question of the Design Lab? Because after that, I think we should come back to what Yannick said about his own vision of the system there. Can you develop that point?
Yes, sure. Yeah, I think just prior to, I think the question you're asking is right. How do we organize ourselves to use the power of multi-sovereign guarantees so that we don't end up with white elephants? We don't choose the wrong projects, we don't guarantee the wrong risks. And the way that it's always done across the world is that you organize it by setting up an institution. That's the only way you do this well, because then you know that that institution has accountability. Think of how the World Bank, what does it do? The World Bank does exactly that same thing. It is an institution which is set up by many countries. And the accountability is to, the shareholders of the other nations, and they invest in it. Now, the World Bank can't do multi-sovereign guarantees. They don't have the capacity to do it. The reason is they have conflicts in their charter. They are supposed to do project-based lending. Initially, they were actually supposed to do only guarantees, surprising. Mm. But they went away from that. And the reason they went away is lots of reasons, but it's the board. The board sitting out there pushed them towards that end. Now, after 50 years, Bretton Woods, you have staff incentives, everything working against blended finance. That's why across the world, blended finance is not moving anywhere. GCF is a new institution. We thought it has, but GCF is too small. Its wings are spread over too many countries, and it doesn't have the capital to do it. So you need, first step you need is an institution. Second step is that institution must have the right capitalization to do it. So if you want to scale up urgency, you need to capitalize it. And the capitalization comes in the form of equity invested in that fund that only undertakes sovereign guarantees, and hopefully over time, that institution develops the skills to avoid the white elephants and chooses exactly the right projects, builds up institution learning. That's how we've built everything over the last 300 years or thousands of years. We learn trial and error. We go through the process, we start small, we build it up, we get the confidence, we go ahead.
I understand. So, Yannick, you should have heard a reaction on that. So, but can you simply, because in your talk, you did not develop, you developed, but I think for the audience would be really useful to perhaps discuss more the institutional context. For example, in the report we have made, and this is more your part, you develop what is the role of the multilateral banks, the governments, and the national banks, the national development banks, okay? And how this can be better organized to leverage the savings, including the domestic savings in developing countries, in a context of scarcity of currencies and this type of thing. Because you have all this section, which is not very well known in our countries, about this organization of the development of the finance, of the organization of the funding of further development in the world is not very well known, and that's important for the West, because when there will be some proposal, for example, to propose multi-sovereign guarantees, this makes sense as a leverage, not only to leverage private funds in our countries, but also to leverage the capacity of mobilizing capital in developing countries and to organize better the supply of green projects. Can you develop on that? Because this in the text that you, I know that you have a lot of things to add to that, and this will not present that much to, in your presentation.
Thanks, Jean-Charles. First, you are not one of the authors of the report. You were the lead author of the report.
Thanks.
Climate finance is like almost any kind of a local finance. You basically invest in what they know, and basically they know basically what's happening in the home country. And the premium to invest in another country is extremely high. So the further you go from the place of the investor, the more expensive the cost of money. And that's the reason why it's so important to make sure that the national institution, the domestic public and private institution, can access domestic and international capitals. Because the bulk of the investment will be done by national institution, but this national institution have to be able to tap international and domestic capital. And we have a number of key players. For example, the national development banks. National development banks have played a key role in the history of Europe. The Caisse des dépôts et consignations was basically put in place just after the defeat of Waterloo to help in the reconstruction of France. KfW was put in place just after the Second World War to help in the reconstruction of Germany. And so there are about 450 national development banks in the world, and they account for 10% of total investment in the world, $2 trillion. About 250 of these national development banks are in developing countries, but only 58 can access international capital markets. And so a big part of our work is to develop the capacity to access these capital markets through floating green bonds, resilient bonds. And that's the reason why we are investing in a green guarantee company to basically increase the credit rating of these bonds by providing them a guarantee, basically enhancing their credit. I mentioned in our case, we do not have a credit rating. So we could only intervene as an equity investor in a company that will be able to leverage the sovereign rating of other equity investors. The MDBs have a key role to play because we are co-financier, we do not originate our projects. And a number of the market creating projects where we basically de-risk a first of its type technology, first of its type business model, are originated and developed by MDBs. And behind the MDBs, in addition to the financial resources, you have 70 years of project origination and development experience. For me, key players also are the national development commercial banks. And so the GCF is partner agnostic too. We work with 113 partners from some of the largest commercial banks in the world, such as Crédit Agricole and BNP Paribas, to small national commercial banks, to multilateral development banks, national development banks, etc.
Okay, given the time, I mean, I will perhaps try and, there's no specific question now so far, because I said that I have, personally I will make a single point, but I commit myself to allow you to go to bed, Yannick, so in 7 minutes now I will stop and we'll pass to French. I would like to for the audience, to put what you said both into a context. The context is international in nature, the context of the international negotiations. And the situation in Europe vis-à-vis that, because, well, what has been said so far is what? Well, we know, we have some ideas about how to rechannel capital, private capital, towards investment in low developing countries, in low carbon investments. That's good bargain for us, because we, some form of rare flexibility, I would say in our jargon, okay, you abate carbon at a cheaper cost in many countries than we could do here. Okay, so that's really important. Then that's the core. Diplomatically, all the negotiation is organized around the commitment in Copenhagen, reiterated in Paris, on the $100 billion of transfers north-south yearly. Likely, there will be a demand for developing countries to go beyond the 100, okay, including in the context of the post-COVID. So our response, I know our common response, George, we agree on that, is that that's good bargain for us in Europe, because if you don't do that by grants only, but mix of grants and public guarantees, you can demonstrate, we did that with DPAC, that's a good bargain for the Treasury in Europe, in France, because of the export content of the project that we help to subsidize, okay? Only 4-5% of export contents will be enough to re-equilibrate our public budget. Perfect. Now the question is that in Europe now, the discussion on preparation of COP26 is dominated by the idea that, well, we in Europe will make some efforts. We'll raise some explicit taxes or implicit carbon price. Implicit, that's it, okay, fine. Then we have to demonstrate that we protect our industries. And then we will discuss about border tax. And we'll enter the discussion, and we discuss about how to raise the border tax, and this is some form of German, Franco-German agreement around this idea. I would like to have, I have a personal reaction about that, but I would really like to have your reaction, because you see, you have border taxes versus generation of new funding mechanisms that are all already in the channel of the discussion. We already committed to that, okay? So that's how you, can you imagine, I would like you to respond to that, because that would be important for the audience here. The approach to the negotiation, the funding, finance, guarantee commitments versus border taxes. Can you say something about that?
You want Yannick to go first?
Perhaps you, because Yannick is a semi-official French, so if you have your...
Okay. I think it's absurd. It's completely the wrong thing to do. So there's a wonderful case study that's going on. I'd urge you to read actually what's happening on the ground. There was a proposal for, you know, wind farms are coming up, offshore wind farms, big effort in Europe, offshore wind farms, North Sea. And the project is going to be built. They started off with a company which was going to be based in the UK to be able to do the localization of employment generation. Within a South Korean company investing in Europe for wind farms, and public money would create jobs in north of England to be able to. Within 4 months, that factory shut down. And the reason the factory shut down is that the most of the components are actually coming from East Asia in Vietnam. So South Korean company contracting. That's how the world works, you know. The cost structures are such that even if you impose or try and impose border taxes, you're not going to be able to make a dent on the problem. Worse, what you're going to do is you're going to set up barriers to the most efficient job. The most efficient job in Europe is one where Vietnam should be building those wind farms in Vietnam, which would be one-tenth the cost of trying to do it. And the jobs would be the high-skilled jobs that the UK is best positioned to do. And so border taxes to me is the worst thing that can happen at this point of time. What you need is a recalibration. Don't think domestically. You need to think globally when you're taking actions on low-carbon strategies over the next decade.
Thank you, Deepak. I was aware of your reaction. I will add some words after that. If Yanni, you want to add something to the end? Or?
Yeah, I guess I'm afraid we all agree that, so first coming back to the $100 billion, why is it important? As mentioned by Deepak, policies have a cost, either for the taxpayer or the ratepayer, but policies have a cost. And one of the limitations of the market shaping approach is that when you come to the number of these policies have a very high cost on the ratepayers or the taxpayers. And so it's extremely important, one, to make sure that you come with the most cost-effective portfolio of policies. And it's there is one thing we know for sure, is that never bet on only one policy or one instrument. Always bet on the portfolios that maximize synergies. We need the $100 billion to basically enable developing countries to put less policies. As mentioned by Deepak, it's $3 billion. Actually, it's between $3 to $7 trillion a year that we have to mobilize. With $100 billion of policies, it's next to nothing compared to the gigantic amount of money that these policies will have to leverage. It's more than 1 to 15, it's 1 to 30, 1 to 70. And so these $100 billion are not even enough to simply come with the politics to catalyze the rest of the financing issues. So, consistent to what I've said previously, never bet on only one instrument, and basically bet only on carbon. Here in the form of internal carbon tax and border tax, the cost will be very, very high.
Thank you. I will simply free you. I mean, to conclude this, I will speak 10 minutes in French for the audience there, but you are still there. Simply to conclude on this question of border taxes versus funding. Absolutely, we, Europe, have to protect our industry. But there's something else to say. We enter a discussion with developing countries about the funding of the carbon transition, how we fulfill the Copenhagen commitments and Paris commitments, and then discuss what happens for steel industry, for some specific sectors, in terms of voluntary agreements. We can discuss that. But if we enter the discussion, I was negotiator at Kyoto, I'm totally aware of that. If we enter the discussion with the question of the product taxes, then we'll have a big trouble, not only for the reasons explained by Deepak, but also for purely diplomatic reasons. We risk to lose the battle. This is why I wanted to have your reaction on that. So the finance is really the key, and that we have to expand that better in the following months. So thank you, Deepak, and thank you, Yannick. This was this trans. We have a plus is 9 hours between the of time lag. That's fine. So I will pick simply 10 minutes now to discuss a specific question, technical question for the audience here. Okay, thank you, Ross. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ciao. Bye. Ciao. Merci. Yeah. Bon, je vais prendre simplement 10 minutes, hein, puisque c'était un peu le jeu, c'est plus précis. La question qui se pose, ça a été dit implicitement avant, c'est bien, j'aurai des risking, j'espère le faire correctement, mais vous voyez bien que finalement, à la fin des fins, pour les acteurs financiers, il y a un problème de crédibilité des actifs. Je caricature à peine. Mais quand on regarde l'état du monde, ce qui a été dit vivement par Deepak quand il parlait des personnes de l'Ouest, il y a beaucoup de vieux, on va dire, et puis du Sud, hein, c'est que l'épargne aujourd'hui dans le monde s'investit beaucoup dans le foncier, dans l'immobilier, pour la question de risque, hein, et pas assez dans les infrastructures, c'est très très documenté par l'OCDE, par exemple. La question maintenant, c'est comment je fais? Pourquoi l'argent va là? Pourquoi? Parce que les gens, ou bien ils veulent des produits très liquides, ou bien ils veulent des produits dont ils pensent qu'ils ont une valeur très intrinsèque, et le foncier et l'immobilier en font partie. Donc la question, c'est qu'il faut bien entendu s'arranger pour qu'il y ait des assets, pour qu'il y ait des classes d'actifs vertes, qui soient suffisamment reconnues. Alors on va admettre que, bon,
priori, s'il y en a des accords multilatéraux, s'il y a des garanties entre plusieurs pays, s'il y a des méthodes de dévaluation qui fonctionnent, ce sera plus facile d'avoir non seulement des investissements que l'on va dérisquer pour ensuite permettre aux fonds de pension et à l'épargne privée de s'investir dessus, mais s'investir d'autant plus qu'il y aura un actif crédible. Alors, il y a un graphique que je voudrais vous montrer, parce que, vous voyez, il est en français celui-là, parce que quelqu'un a dit, je ne sais pas si c'est Déo, qu'il y avait un problème à résoudre, qui est que les ingénieurs devraient rester des ingénieurs, n'est-ce pas ? Et que c'est important pour la finance. Bon, alors, je suis un ancien HEC, donc je suis pas ingénieur, mais j'ai quelques notions quand même de ce que c'est qu'un minimum de calcul. Et dans la dernière période de ma vie, j'ai été très frappé, non seulement par l'écart entre les logiques d'ingénieur et les logiques d'économiste, mais aussi logique d'ingénieur, logique d'économiste et logique de financier. Pourquoi je fais ce détour ? Parce que savoir totalement avec la question de la crédibilité des investissements. Est-ce qu'il est possible ? J'ai discuté avec beaucoup de gens comme ça. Et là, il y a une sorte de seuil de non-crédibilité, c'est pour ça que Deepak a parlé de Design Lab, c'est que le financier moyen va vous dire « démontrez-moi que l'argent sera bien employé et que c'est du solide bon, ». Évidemment, dit comme ça, je ne peux jamais le prouver. Or, il faut savoir que il y a par expérience dans les analyses sur le développement, sur les projets de développement, même avec des systèmes qui ne sont pas très bons, hein, comme le mécanisme de développement propre, il y a une compétence accumulée dans le domaine d'ingénieurs pour essayer de trouver des moyens d'évaluer les tonnes évitées dans tel ou tel pays, dans tel ou tel secteur. Bien entendu, c'est des expériences qui sont très très séparées, qui sont pas harmonisées, et il y a tout un mouvement aujourd'hui pour essayer de les standardiser. Déo disait qu'il signifiait du mot, mais il a bien raison de le dire, enfin c'est bien une tendance. Standardiser pour quoi faire, pour aller plus vite, et pour donner de la crédibilité. Alors, cette standardisation, elle est possible, parce qu'il y a de l'autre côté, c'est une partie de la littérature que les gens ne connaissent pas, élaborée avec beaucoup d'ingénieurs, et d'économistes quand même aussi, vous avez des modèles de prospective qui essayent, il y en a à l'école des ponts, puisque le CIRED fait partie des producteurs de ce type de modèles, qui essayent de projeter l'économie mondiale sur différentes contraintes, et qui donnent, je dirais, des évaluations, bien sûr avec des fourchettes d'incertitude, hein, pour démontrer que finalement, une économie d'énergie dans un logement au Brésil, à Rio de Janeiro, c'est pas la même chose qu'à Paris, qui n'est pas la même chose qu'à Bergen. Ok ? C'est-à-dire qu'on a au moins des grandes idées, bien sûr, avec des modèles qui ont leurs incertitudes, okay, mais qui sont bouclés macroéconomiquement. Donc, vous pouvez vous dire qu'en gros, il y a tout un enjeu sur les données, qui est qu'il y a beaucoup de données très séparées, il y a une capacité de les organiser dans des modèles de prospective. Alors, pourquoi je mets ce graphique-là ? C'est que ce graphique-là montre qu'est-ce qu'on peut en faire. Vous imaginez que des ingénieurs peuvent travailler avec des financiers sur, c'est le Design Lab dont il parlait, dire comment je peux utiliser l'information pour arriver à une évaluation plus précise, plus rapide, avec des fourchettes d'incertitude, c'est évident ça, mais ça fait partie du jeu ça, des projets bas carbone dans tel pays, dans tel secteur. Et toute l'idée pour passer à un des problèmes clés sur les assets, c'est non seulement qu'ils soient crédibles, ils sont certifiés parce qu'ils ont été sélectionnés par des méthodes que l'on partage et qui sont à peu près sûres, harmonisé, il y a toute une bataille qui va se mener sur ça, mais non seulement ça, ils ont une valeur. Et cette valeur, c'est ce qui est marqué ici. Ici, il faut savoir, si vous voulez, que dans la discussion sur les taxes carbone, on a parlé de prix notionnel, de valeur tutélaire du carbone, dans l'accord de Paris, l'article 108 parle de la valeur sociale de la mitigation, c'est l'équivalent de notre valeur tutélaire. J'accorde une valeur A au carbone évité. Et vous imaginez que pour que les choses marchent internationalement, il faudrait idéalement qu'on s'accorde sur une valeur notionnelle à l'échelle mondiale pour accorder d'une valeur, par exemple, on garantit des projets au prorata en leur donnant une valeur qui est c'est un nombre de dollars ou d'euros par tonne. C'est pas pareil d'harmoniser des valeurs conventionnelles que d'harmoniser des taxes, hein, parce que les taxes, c'est impossible. Il y a un article 136, je crois, de l'accord de Paris qui dit que, de toute façon, il n'y aura pas de taxes internationales. Elles sont à l'échelle de chaque pays. Par contre, il est tout à fait possible de s'organiser pour avoir une valeur tutélaire. Ici, valeur sociale de la médication, article 108, il s'appelle comme ça. D'où est-ce que ça vient? C'est pas n'importe quoi. Ici, j'ai mis simplement des fourchettes. Bande haute, bande basse, vous voyez, les VSM mondiales, c'est calculé comme ça a été fait en France. Hein. Vous prenez les modèles mondiaux, il y en a une quinzaine, une vingtaine, vous les faites tourner avec une cible, et ça vous donne des valeurs du carbone. Alors vous avez 39, 68, 154, 66, 154, 286, c'est des maximums et des minimums de ressemblance. Vous tirez des modèles mondiaux. Qu'est-ce que ça coûte à l'humanité, à la marge, d'éviter du carbone? Alors, ces chiffres sont plus bas à 2030 que ceux qui ont été dit tout à l'heure, quoique pour preuve, ils sont pour, voilà. Mais il faut savoir que ce sont des chiffres mondiaux, hein. C'est pas des chiffres France seulement. Et toute l'idée, c'est que vous pourriez utiliser ces chiffres pour calibrer des garanties. Pourquoi? Parce que vous voyez bien que ces chiffres, ils augmentent dans le temps. 39, 68 et 154. Quel est le gros intérêt pour l'évaluation des projets et éventuellement la formalisation d'actifs qui sont reconnus? Ben, si vous regardez sur la droite, là, maintenant, selon que vous actualisez ça à 3 ou 5%, le gros problème des taux d'intérêt, c'est quoi? C'est que ça pénalise les investissements de long terme. C'est très clair. Mais si vous calculez si vous calibrez vos garanties en fonction de la trajectoire que vous avez là, 39, 68, 154, vous vous rendez compte que cette trajectoire est orientée vers le haut. Et si vous regardez la valeur actualisée du projet, on prend la bande haute, c'est pas grave, haute ou basse, vous vous rendez compte qu'un projet qui dure 40 ans, là, ou 30 ans, je prends 30 ans, c'est pas grave, sa valeur actualisée, elle est quasiment équivalente à celle du projet de 10 ans. Si j'ai 5%, si je prends un taux d'actualisation de 3%, ben, c'est le compte, elle est même supérieure. C'est-à-dire qu'il y a tout un enjeu là-dedans qui est de dire que, et c'est une réflexion pour les financiers, et qui est en lien avec les modèles d'ingénieurs, là, d'accord? Comment je peux m'arranger pour que ce que je vous montre là soit transformé en outil pour l'analyse financière. Je m'arrête là-dessus. D'accord? C'est-à-dire qu'en gros, c'est un enjeu très important. Hein. C'est que si vous voulez, là vous avez le fait que s'il y a l'accord dont on parle là avec des garanties multilatérales, si par ailleurs on arrive à démontrer qu'on peut évaluer les projets avec des marges d'erreur, mais de façon pas trop idiote, et si en plus on peut se mettre d'accord sur une valeur qui monte dans le temps, alors là on a la base pour faire que les financiers, dans quelques temps, se rendent compte que investir dans du bas carbone, c'est investir sur des assets dont la valeur ne va pas plonger dans le temps, mais au contraire, hein, va faire un peu comme ce qu'ils espèrent de l'immobilier. Donc j'étais très rapide là-dessus, mais c'est important, je veux le dire, parce que c'est vraiment le lien, s'il y a bien un lien, pour ça que j'ai improvisé là-dessus, hein, c'est le lien entre la culture d'ingénieur, on va dire, la culture finance, elle se trouve sur ce 73, 72 et 68, d'accord? Comment on arrive à le faire en pratique, ça? Je pense qu'il y a, c'est comment on étend ce qui a été dit sur la valeur tutélaire du carbone en France, comment on peut l'étendre dans ce genre de choses? Parce qu'il faut être clair, hein, si on le fait pas, la valeur tutélaire du carbone, c'est très simple, c'est très sympathique, mais comme ça ne peut jamais être une taxe, comme on dit en anglais, this has no teeth. Ok, on le fait, mais c'est très bien. Là, l'avantage, c'est d'essayer de se dire comment je transforme un prix implicite comme outil d'orientation des investissements et de réorientation. On a beaucoup de littérature sur ça. C'est une invitation à votre communauté de travailler avec des gens qui font de la prospective technologique. Ces chiffres ne viennent pas de rien. Ce sont des chiffres qui sont produits avec des indices d'ingénieurs sur les coûts d'appâtement. Il est évident que c'est plus compliqué que ce que je vous raconte là, mais c'est un peu le... Alors, je termine là-dessus. C'est l'implicite dans ce que disait Deepak sur le Design Lab. Il y a toute une période, dans les 2-3 ans qui viennent, il y a du travail à faire dans ce domaine-là pour ben, comment on lit cette formation d'assets, cette valorisation hein, à ce qu'on vient de discuter sur la négociation internationale. Voilà, ben, écoutez, je vous remercie pour cette session. Merci, j'arrête là.
Nos deux intervenants étrangers pour leur contribution. C'est extrêmement utile à l'École des Ponts de montrer qu'on est capable de faire des liens entre les trois domaines que sont la mesure de performance des projets, le financement, avec un focus sur les pays émergents, quand même un lieu important d'expression pour les ingénieurs de l'École des Ponts. Merci encore à vous, merci à toi Jean-Charles, et puis on reprendra notre troisième table ronde à 17h comme prévu. À tout à l'heure. Merci.